Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Rusty Jacobs.
And it's time for a look back at the week in state politics. Joining me are Rob Schofield, Executive Director of the Progressive NC Policy Watch, and Becky Gray, Senior Vice President with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Happy Friday.
Thanks.
Hey, Rusty.
North Carolina held primary elections this week. The 9th Congressional District was the site of one of the biggest upsets. Incumbent Robert Pittenger lost a close race to his challenger, Mark Harris, the former pastor who lost to Pittenger by 134 votes 2 years ago. Becky, what was your reaction to the outcome?
I was a little bit surprised. We knew it was going to be a close race. Some of the indications I was getting before Tuesday indicated that Robert Pittenger, the incumbent, did have the advantage. The thing that I think is really interesting is that this really elevates that congressional race to, I think, the very top concern nationally. So we're going to be getting a lot of attention on this. Mark Harris, in some of his remarks after the election, said statistics and running those numbers are one thing, but really understanding sort of the heart and soul of that district is something else. He feels pretty confident that he will be successful. But first of all, a little bit of a surprise in the outcome, but the big deal is it's now going to get a lot of national attention.
And why does Harris, instead of Pittenger, against Dan McCready, the Democrat, make it more vulnerable or more flippable as far as Democrats are concerned?
I'm not sure, unless we're talking about the power of incumbents and people who do those kind of things and use all kind of statistics and numbers and formulas and things. I think that there's an advantage to having an incumbent. But again, I think to Mark Harris's point, and I think this could be said for lots and lots of races across North Carolina, numbers and statistics and data are one thing. How voters actually vote can sometimes be a very different thing.
Rob, Democrat Dan McCready easily won his 9th district primary and will face Harris with a lot more cash on hand at this point.
Right.
So are Democrats right to consider, as Becky may have suggested, that the 9th is a flippable district?
Oh, I think they're doing cartwheels. I think they're very excited that Reverend Harris is the opponent. They see him as an ultra-conservative preacher as opposed to sort of just a veteran politician like Pittenger was. McCready, I thought it was interesting that McCready actually got more votes in the Democratic primary than the two Republican candidates combined. Now, there were probably some other local issues that played into that, local sheriff's races and things like that, but it's still, in a supposedly conservative Republican district, it's pretty striking that he did so well. This is a very attractive, young, up-and-coming politician who's got solar farms and
Marine
Corps combat vet. I mean, you know, it's hard to draw up someone from central casting more impressive for a young candidate. And in contrast, you know, Reverend Harris is not that. He's a conservative preacher, and that's not traditionally who we think of sending to Washington on behalf of our constituents. So anyway, should be a fascinating race. I think you should be prepared for lots of TV ads and lots of money spent on the media markets in the coming months.
And lots of money from outside sources.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Becky, what other congressional races drew your attention?
I was watching the Walter Jones district in Congressional District 3 down in the eastern part of the state. Walter Jones has been in the Congress for decades. Before that, his father was in Congress. He always draws some challenges and did again this time. I thought that the race might be a little closer than it was. Walter Jones was successful in winning that primary, and it's such a strong Republican district that, I mean, we're likely see him go on to Washington. But, yeah, he got 43% and in a four-person race for that. He has said that this is his last race. Given that, I think what we'll see, probably what his opponents, Scott Dacey and Phil Law, started on Wednesday was to gear up for 2 years for that race when it will be open. A lot of interest there. I was a little bit surprised at that. The other one that I was watching was the Ted Budd District 13. That's another one that we're hearing nationally. Democrats consider this may be a flippable seat. They're paying attention to it. Of course, Ted Budd, first first term, seeking his second term. Kathy Manning won the Democratic primary. Very well-funded. She's a philanthropist, has been a longtime Democrat donor, immigration lawyer, and she has already raised a lot of money to put in that race. If this district is elevated to one of national attention, again, as we just mentioned with the Mark Harris, Dan McGreedy, we'll see a lot of money. A lot of national money, a lot of independent money coming in.
I noticed on Ted Budd's, there was a Facebook post from his campaign the next morning congratulating Kathy Manning on a hard-bought campaign, hard-bought effort from with the help of Nancy Pelosi. Rob, was that one of the races you drew
your attention? Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this both the Kathy Manning victory and I think the Linda Coleman victory here in the Triangle area, both sort of, you know, we're hearing about the year of the woman and the fact that so many women have been motivated to run for office, obviously in response to Donald Trump and his behavior and what he stands for and what he represents. And I thought it was indicative that there's some validity to that. Coleman, I think, was expected. She was not the big money candidate in the second congressional. Was expected
to defend off Ken Romney.
Yeah, and it was expected that might be a tough fight, but it really wasn't. She had, I guess, name recognition, has been a veteran politician in North Carolina, but Manning as well. Two, you know, strong woman candidates, and we're seeing that at the state legislative level as well. So I think it does bespeak that there is a bit of a female wave in politics that's taking place in response to Trump, and it's quite possible that it could continue through to November.
Rob, since you bring up a female wave, let me turn to you, Becky, and ask about the Dwayne Hall defeat in one of the Wake County legislative seats, and whether that was triggered by the Me Too movement or whether that is part and parcel of this the female wave.
I think that was triggered by Dwayne Hall's behavior that many people found offensive. I tell you, in that race, I was surprised that his opponent won by such a large margin. To be honest with you. Yeah, Allison Dahl, thank you. If there was a surprise in that race, it was that there was such a large margin there. Dwayne Hall, of course, had, and Rob's organization is the one that broke that story. Dwayne Hall consistently had denied the allegation, said he didn't do anything wrong. Even after Roy Cooper and others calling for his resignation, he stayed in the district, said he would let the constituents of that House district determine who they wanted to represent.
In fact, wanted the voters to make the
exactly.
decision.
Exactly, and they did.
Yeah. Rob, and if you can, Rob, I mean, maybe fill us in. I mean, your NC Policy Watch broke the story on these sexual misconduct allegations, unwanted sexual advances. Again, allegations that Dwayne Hall has denied, but the result he invited the voters to render, they did.
He certainly did, and I thought it was, you know, sort of telling and strange that he ducked the media throughout the campaign. He literally didn't respond to requests for calls from, you know, traditional mainstream news outlets. The News and Observer here in his hometown, you know, he wouldn't answer their questions. That didn't sound to me like a candidate who was, you know, likely to do well. It didn't seem like a very good omen. And then he had an unfortunate incident in which he confronted a very nice woman who was just passing out literature in a parking lot and gave her a hard time. It seemed really to be sort of a how to ruin a promising political career 101 was what Dwayne Hall was engaging in. And it's and Becky's right. He was thoroughly trounced, and he outspent his opponent by huge margins, did lots of mailers. And I was trying to total up. I mean, I think he only garnered maybe 1,700 votes. I mean, it was truly a very poor showing, and he must have spent a lot of money per vote. So I think it would seem to be the end of his political career.
Let's turn to another big casualty in state legislative primaries, Justin Burr, the Stanley County Republican who spearheaded judicial redistricting efforts. I mean, this was the face of bringing new maps to judicial races in North Carolina. Becky, what'd you think of that outcome?
You're exactly right. I'm not sure that that had an impact in I'm not sure that Justin Burr's championing the judicial districts were really what affected the outcome in this race. You know, I mean, we heard news reports that said, yeah, people in Stanley County, they don't know about that. They don't care about that. That's not what's driving them to the poll. His opponent, Wayne Sasser, spent a lot of money. Justin Burr had a really tough primary 2 years ago where there were allegations of some special interest and some other things, you know, that we're doing. I also heard reports that people in the district really did not understand that he was part of the leadership leadership in Raleigh and, quite frankly, didn't really care. So as far as the judicial redistricting, this is an issue that has come before the General Assembly. The judicial districts have not been addressed as a state as a whole since the 1960s. This is an important issue, one that the General Assembly needs to at least discuss and look at, no matter whose name is associated with that. I think that discussion will go on. I think that Justin Burr lost his race for reasons other than being kind of the outspoken voice for judicial districts.
So, Rob, was Justin Burr too close to the leadership and not close enough to his constituents? And what do you think his defeat does for the judicial redistricting efforts that are driven by the GOP leadership?
Yeah, I think that that's quite possible that he'd lost touch with some of his constituents. I think he had a reputation as someone who was, you know, looking out for himself in Raleigh. Here's a professional bail bondsman who has stood in opposition to bail bond reform. He is someone who was driving this judicial redistricting and never really explained his motives for doing it. I hope it sends a signal to legislators that they need to take a step back. If the champion of this reform has been soundly defeated, I think it's a sign we need to, come on, let's slow down. Let's have a talk about this. I don't disagree that we need redistricting reform in the judiciary, but clearly it needs to be done in a thoughtful, open, transparent way, not behind closed doors, not drawn up in Justin Burr's office, which was basically the way it had been done before. So, yeah, and I will say also that it's a very positive result for the cause of bail bond reform, which is a growing movement amongst conservatives and liberals, that we need some change in our bail system in North Carolina, that it is wrongfully keeping people in jail who are innocent, that it is burdening the poor. And it is because we have this, instead of going to a public pretrial system, instead of this private bail bond system that a lot of states are abandoning, and Burr was a big defender of that because that was his business. So I hope that makes for some progress in that area as well.
Becky, are Rob's hopes well-founded?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of issues that, you know, as we go through these campaigns, as we see different issues brought up, as they are important to constituents, whether it's in one district or whether it reverberates across the state, I think that's part of the election process and why these debate and discussions and town halls and these election results and kind of what we glean from that, I think all of that is important. But let me just mention with Justin Burr, too, you know, in our discussion just a few minutes ago, we were talking about Dwayne Hall and whether or not his political career may be over, given his loss and the things that led to his loss. I would argue for Justin Burr, this is a young man. He was 22 when he was elected to the General Assembly. He has moved up in leadership. He has taken some really heavy lifts, like this judicial redistricting, which, no matter what your position on it is, I think we would all agree it's a complicated, complex issue. You have to be able to articulate your viewpoints and those kind of things. It's been fun watching the General Assembly, as I do and have for a number of years, to see individuals kind of grow in their role as legislators and leaders in the state. And so, although I think this loss is always hard, and I haven't spoken to Representative Burr. I'm sure that he is recuperating from that. He was back in Raleigh the next day at a committee doing his work. I think Justin Burr is someone that we're going to hear more from. I don't know whether he'll run for public office again, but he understands the legislative process. He is a conservative, a committed conservative, and I think that we'll continue to see him and benefit from some of his leadership in other ways.
So he'll be back.
He'll be back.
I just say I hope.
And I don't know whether he'll be back in the General Assembly, but I think just, you know, as we look at the environment and the landscape of North Carolina, he's a name we're probably going to hear again.
I would just say I don't doubt that he's very ambitious. I do hope that if he does come back, he is chastened somewhat by this and learns that he had really adopted the sort of image and the tactics of sort of old school, ram things through, draw things behind closed doors, rather than engaging with the public, allowing for public debate, mastering the skill of winning debates. His was very much my way or the highway, sort of old school running a committee. I hope that at the least, if he does come back, that maybe he will have learned a few lessons about how to be a more effective lawmaker.
Well, congressional and legislative races were just part of the primary picture. There were also two big sheriff races that popped out to me, Durham and Buncombe County, not to mention the Durham District Attorney race. In Durham, a lot of anger over the arrest and prosecution of protesters who toppled a Confederate monument. And in Buncombe County, you had the public outcry over a former Asheville police officer beating a black man accused of jaywalking. Becky, what do you think was behind the unseating of Durham Sheriff Mike Andrews and the District Attorney, Roger Eccles?
You know, that was an interesting race. There were interesting sheriff's race across the state, and in many jurisdictions, the sheriff race is what drove the turnout. I mean, we had low turnout, what, 14%? But in pockets and where these contentious sheriff races were, that really drove drove people to the polls. Kind of an interesting phenomenon. You mentioned Buncombe County and Durham. Let me bring Mecklenburg County into that mix as well. And what we're seeing is in North Carolina and across the country, as people migrate and choose where to live, we're seeing, and this is a trend and this is sort of a generalization, but progressives are moving to the urban areas, conservatives are staying in the rural areas. So as we've seen this change, this sort of ideological change in our cities, we're seeing this in the elections as well. And so what I observed from the Durham race, Buncombe County certainly, and Mecklenburg County, is the sheriffs are being elected more on progressive ideals. In Durham and Mecklenburg County, the sheriffs ran on not complying with immigration law. I mean, I think the sheriff in Mecklenburg County said he was not going to comply with the federal immigration law. So it's kind of a trend that we're seeing that I think is going to be interesting. You know, sheriffs have one job, public safety. And so as we see this evolve, I think it will be interesting to see how that evolves and whether or not perhaps there's some sort of backlash to that, or if this is the direction that we're going to go, where you kind of have these mavericks, if you will, in the urban areas who were saying outright, we are not going to comply with federal law.
Quentin Miller in Buncombe County, yes. the Democratic nominee for sheriff in that county, also pledged not to enroll in the 287G.
Right, and that was exactly the case in Mecklenburg County as well.
So you've got one mold, but it's interesting that you call him Maverick. You've also got the Joe Arpaio mold, which is with the other kind of Maverick, Rob.
Yeah, well, 2 points. I'm not sure it's about complying with federal law. I think it's about the degree to which you're cooperating with federal officials, and there's no absolute mandate that you be a 287G jurisdiction or that you go along with enforcing Trump's immigration policies. And I will say that I agree with Becky about progressive voters. Progressive voters were looking for any way possible to vote against Trump. They want to do something about Trump. They don't like him. They oppose his policies. They oppose what he stands for. And that was a very clear, obvious way to give the raspberry to Trump, to say, hey, man, we're going to be against your policies on immigration, on the treatment of African Americans in our society, on the treatment of immigrants. We're saying no to that. And this is the most clear-cut way we have to do it. We're going to vote against your policies by voting against people who were trying to cooperate with your policies. Instead, vote for people who want to contest it and debate you over them. And so I think you're right. I think it has to do with our becoming increasingly progressive urban centers and the voters there standing up and saying, you know, that we're not going to have someone like this representing us anymore.
And in Mecklenburg County and Durham County, sitting sheriffs were defeated by these challengers. I'm not sure about in Buncombe County. Is somebody from the police?
Sheriff in Buncombe County is
resigning.
That's correct. And he had a successor that he was hoping would replace him.
And that guy was defeated.
That's correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're really seeing a change. And I think Rob's right. I mean, I think that is the reason why. I mean, there's just kind of a sea change and more progressive ideological drivers in this. Again, the sheriff's job is public safety. And as this rolls out and as there's some time that elapses, if public safety is compromised, then I think we may see a backlash against some of this.
Public safety. But then again, Quentin Miller, the Democratic nominee for Buncombe County Sheriff, said that he wants to do de-escalation training. So it's not just about enforcement.
Beating black men on the street and stopping that is about public safety. Protecting immigrants and making it so that they feel comfortable coming in and reporting crime and not being deported because they report a murder or a domestic violence situation is about public safety. So I would argue that it's very unlikely there'll be a backlash, because I think we'll see more and improved and enhanced public safety in the communities where we have these kinds of policies in place.
Just remembering that we are a nation of law. And so where that comes down, again, it's just an interesting trend, and I think we're seeing it not just in North Carolina but across the country. So certainly something to be monitoring and watching, and some changes that we may see in the next election cycle.
Turning to Wednesday, legislators returning to Raleigh for the short session, primarily to make adjustments to the biennial budget. Though they'll be greeted by angry teachers planning protests for higher pay, more spending on education. GOP leaders held a telephone press conference Monday to hail a fourth consecutive revenue surplus. They said lawmakers were working hard to get a budget agreement in place before the July start of the fiscal year. In other words, a truly short session. Rob, do you think Republican policies should be credited with the revenue projections?
I don't think credit's the right word. I mean, clearly we have a surplus because of the policies that have been enacted. But the surplus is that's what happens when you systematically disinvest in public schools. You starve education. You starve environmental protection. You starve the prisons. You starve the courts. Oh, what a surprise. You have a little bit more money left over. But, of course, we have given massive tax breaks to people at the top, to profitable corporations. And sure, you're going to have a surplus as a result of that. It's not near, it's a drop in the bucket as to what is needed in terms of spending. We ought to be spending billions more dollars on essential services and structures. And so they'll tout this as a quote unquote surplus, but it's not going to make any difference in terms of really rescuing those services that have been so badly decimated in recent years. I mean, when you look and you adjust it for inflation, despite these talk of pay raises for teachers in recent years that have been given to some teachers. Teacher pay in North Carolina is down more than 9% since 2009 when you adjust for inflation. That's one of the biggest drops in the country. That's why the teachers are coming out. I don't know that it's necessarily anger. It's just a determination that they want respect, that they feel as if they have been basically the subject of abuse for the past decade. And that's why we're seeing these unprecedented reports of numbers of upwards of 15,000 people now coming to Raleigh next Wednesday. It's going to be an extraordinary first day of the session.
Becky, the governor has his own budget priorities. Do you think we'll see some special miraculous reconciliation between him and legislative leaders during the short session?
Probably not. They just are on polar opposite ends of the role of government, the size and scope of government, how you approach state budgeting. I thought it was really interesting this year, this budget cycle, that the Republican leadership in the budget negotiations, the first thing they did is they set the amount of money that they're going to spend. That's what they established first. What we've seen in past, what we've already seen from Roy Cooper is the wish list. I'm going to spend $130 million for this. I'm going to spend $5 million for this. I'm going to spend $10 million for this. What on the other end of it is setting the amount of money that can be spent that we can afford based on revenue numbers. This isn't something they just pulled out of the hat. Actually, the amount of money that they have set is 3.8% increase over last year. So, you know, more people are moving to North Carolina. We have more kids in the classroom. We have more people on the road. You know, there's a growth in the government that is tied to the growth in population. But it's reasonable. Just like in our family budgets, you know, when you're making that out, you don't sit down and start with the list of everything you'd like to have. You start with the amount of money that you've got coming in, and then you set your priorities from there. As far as the revenue that's coming in, we do have a surplus. North Carolina's economy is growing. It is growing faster than our neighbors. It's growing faster than the national economy. It's because of tax cuts, reining in regulations, reining in the growth of government and making things more streamlined, more efficient, understanding what we can afford, and also allowing people to keep more of the money that they've earned. So we have a revenue surplus. What we've seen in the past couple years, I hope we see it again this year, is some of that money, that extra money that we have, being put into savings accounts. We have an obligation to our teachers, to our state employees, to make sure that the pension plan is fully funded. We also have promised health care benefits to our teachers and state employees. We need to make sure that that fund is solvent so that we can deliver on the promises that we are making to them. And then returning some money back to people who earned it. You know, let them decide how to spend the money. You know, they've got to put food on the table. They've got to buy sneakers for their kids. They've got to put gas in their car to get to work. You know, let people who earn the money keep more of it. I think we're on the right track. I think this short session is going to be another example of fiscal management and keeping North Carolina growing, the economy growing, and making more opportunities available to more people across North Carolina.
In the weeks and months leading up to this short session, lawmakers have been discussing school safety. There have been committee meetings on environmental quality issues. Rob, what other issues do you think the short session will accomplish besides the budget?
Well, it would be nice if we would talk about some of those issues. The legislative leaders are saying we're only going to be here for a couple of weeks. They've basically purporting anyway to have already negotiated out the budget without any public input, without any process beforehand. They're just going to present it signed, sealed, and delivered presumably the first day or the first week of the session. So it's anybody's guess. I mean, at one point we were hearing very serious talk that lawmakers, legislative leaders anyway, wanted to push through some constitutional amendments to put on the ballot that would make some fundamental changes to North Carolina law in November. So, you know, that's the way they play things under the current leadership regime in Raleigh. They keep things close to the vest. They don't share much with the public. They're not about public process or open government or open debate. It's all about springing things at the last minute. I fully expect that there'll be some things we hadn't anticipated that will be rolled out and be expected to pass in a day or two. And unfortunately, that's just the way things have been run in Raleigh these days. I hope there is a continued backlash to that from amongst the public that are going to say, hey, let's talk about what our needs are. What are our actual needs in education and the environment? Not having some artificial cap on the budget placed there just because some powerful legislators decided a few years ago we got to give billions of dollars of tax cuts to the wealthy, the people who don't need it. That's basically the reason we have this surplus. It's the reason we have this so-called target for spending that Senator Berger and Speaker Moore have identified. It's a function of the tax cuts that they imposed a few years ago, not what people what our services are actually needed in this state. So I hope there's a big pushback, but I expect there won't be much opportunity for it.
Becky, do you foresee any other legislative accomplishments beyond budget adjustments?
Well, and a lot of things we already know. Yeah, a lot of things we already know. Don't forget that, you know, the process we have in North Carolina is that during the long session, a two-year budget is drawn up. So we have a budget in place for this year. You know, it's already been voted on, bipartisan support for this. You know, what we're seeing are some tweaks to that budget. What we already know are teachers are going to get over a 6% pay increase, fifth consecutive pay increase that teachers will get. There will be 15% of the revenue over last year, the surplus revenue over last year, automatically goes into savings, again, for the pensions and those kind of things, rainy day funds. I mean, that's good fiscal management. So there's a lot of things. Oh, tax cuts. That's the other thing. Additional tax cuts will go into effect. Standard deduction, that zero bracket area that you pay no taxes at all for married couples filing jointly, that will go from $17,500 to $20,000. So when you talk about middle class tax cuts, you talk about helping lower income folks. It's exactly what this is designed for. Personal income is going to go down again for everybody across North Carolina, and the corporate tax rate will tick down again. So, you know, this whole notion of, oh, we don't know what they're going to have in the budget, it's all done behind closed doors. If you're paying attention and you've read last year's budget that has the this year's budget in there with these things baked in again, over 6% increase for teacher pay again this year. All those things are already in there.
Pretty soon they might get back to where they were in 2009.
We'll leave it at that. Rob Schofield, Executive Director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray, Senior Vice President of the John Locke Foundation.
Thanks, Rusty.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.